TUC Radio, Time of Useful Consciousness.
Ralf Nader calls for ceasefire now in Gaza. On November 3rd, the Ralf Nader Radio Hour issued this urgent appeal. This is a 25-minute excerpt from a one-hour special edition of Nader's weekly talk show, broadcast on the Pacifica Radio Network and as podcast. Ralf Nader, former head of Public Citizen, is an author, lecturer, attorney, and talk show host. Nader's regular co-host, Steve Scrovan, introduces this special edition calling for ceasefire now in Gaza.
Ralf, tell our audience why we are doing this special report today.
Because time is of the essence. Events in Gaza are accelerating the massive destruction of civilian infrastructure. The textbook definition of genocide is underway. The invasion by Israeli overwhelming military power is underway. All kinds of innocent lives are being destroyed. And there's the prospect of a wider war involving neighboring countries and maybe beyond. So there's no time to lose here. We want to focus on what Congress is doing and not doing under its constitutional duties.
And to help us with that, we've invited a guest on today. Our guest is Laura Friedman. Laura Friedman is the president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. She's a leading authority on the Middle East, with particular expertise on U.S. foreign policy in the region, on Israel-Palestine, and on the way Middle East and Israel-Palestine-related issues play out in Congress and in U.S. domestic politics. Ms. Friedman is a former officer in the U.S. Foreign Service with diplomatic postings in Jerusalem, Washington, Tunis, and Beirut. Welcome to the Ralf Nader Radio Hour, Laura Friedman.
Thanks, Steve. Very happy to be here.
Welcome indeed. Almost every day, Laura, we hear top U.S. officials make the following statement. We'll continue to send arms to Israel without conditions in order for them to defend themselves. And Vice President Harris in London just said the same thing verbatim, as do many members of Congress. Now, you cover Congress on the Middle East issues like probably no one else. So let's start with this unconditional. There's no such thing as military aid to any country, including Israel, unconditionally, because there's a federal statute of longstanding that says the U.S. cannot send military arms to countries that use them offensively. And under the Leahy Amendment, after Senator Patrick Leahy from Vermont, the U.S. cannot send military shipments to countries that systemically violate human rights. And of course, Israel has done both in contradiction. Has anybody ever on Capitol Hill called their colleagues to account that they are not supporting the implementation of laws that they passed themselves?
That is a great question. It's the $3.8 billion question, which is how much we give Israel right now a year in military aid. I think for the defenders of Israel, they would argue that this point is not relevant because Israel doesn't ever do anything wrong. It doesn't violate any U.S. requirements, any laws. So to suggest otherwise, they would argue is anti-Israel and probably anti-Semitic. There have been efforts for years to bring up the issue of the Leahy Law. It's clear that there is no appetite within any administration from either party to actually impose Leahy Law monitoring on aid to Israel. I would say it's also difficult. Aid to Israel is granted in a way that is unlike any other aid for any country in the world, which is that pretty much every other case, the U.S. Congress appropriates money, which is then available for countries to use to buy U.S. weapons, and the U.S. retains oversight of those weapons and how it's used and all of that. With Israel, we appropriate money at the beginning of the fiscal year, at this point, $3.8 billion a year. That money is then handed to Israel in cash, and Israel can use it when it wants to. It can earn interest off it while it sits in banks, and a portion of that money Israel can spend outside the U.S. It can spend it on things inside Israel. So it's not even like all of it is coming back to the U.S. But for the stuff that is coming back, again, normally the U.S. maintains a tight hold on it because the money isn't appropriated until there is an actual request to buy a specific weapon. And then there can be the oversight. In the case of Israel, the money is already out the door. So there's just been no appetite at all for in any way imposing any scrutiny at all.
Well, let's take a recent case study, very recent, the $14.3 billion appropriation to send to Israel. Apart from the substantive pro and cons of that to a technological, military, and economic superpower that Israel has come to be, with a social safety net greater than our safety net in the U.S. They have universal health insurance, for example. They have stronger union laws than we do by far, for example. This was just passed by the House of Representatives, tied into a $14 billion cut in the IRS budget over time to allegedly pay for it, which of course would include losing all the recovery of tax evaders who are superly wealthy and large corporations and create even greater deficits. But let's look at the procedure here. Bills like this are supposed to go through the appropriation authorization hearing process. There wasn't any. The House Foreign Relations Committee didn't have hearings. Hearings involve witnesses, not just briefings of administration officials. It went through the Rules Committee without deliberation. And then it went to the floor, and the battle was mostly a battle of epithets and accusations, rather than what is in the package. And what is in the package includes a portion of money for R&D for advanced lasers, for example. So a lot of things in the package that were voted on, they had no clue about it. They were just heel-clicking it through the House, the Republicans primarily. So you have a whole sequence of violation of congressional procedures under its constitutional duties. Now, why do you think even liberals in Congress who are skittish about challenging the pro-Israeli lobby, which we'll get to in a moment, why don't they make procedural propriety an issue?
Look, I mean, when it comes to aid for Israel, it is bipartisan and consensus. And until that changes, whether something changes at the grassroots, which really compels members of Congress to listen, or different members elected who are willing to stand up, the bottom line is there isn't any controversy about aid to Israel. The only controversy is which party can claim to be more pro-Israel by giving more. In this package, I mean, the controversy around this $14.3 billion, and there is controversy, this is not going to move quickly. There's political challenges for moving this forward. But those challenges are completely unrelated to giving money to Israel. Basically, everybody agrees we want to give this money to Israel. We want to give it as fast as we can and just move it right through. The challenges here is that Biden wants to attach to it Ukraine money and some other things, and the Republicans want to cut those off because they don't want to fund them. And the new speaker says that it has to be offset. And normally with emergency spending for things like, you know, natural disasters or wars, you don't offset it. That basically says that for us to pay for this, we're not going to spend this unless we can pay for it by cutting something else. I don't know if there's any precedent for that under either party to basically say emergency spending has to be offset by cuts to regular spending. Regular spending has already been cut to the bone. And that is going to slow this down. I will say there's an interesting kind of side story which is playing out, which is, you know, Speaker Johnson, by requiring this to be offset by cuts somewhere, is actually imposing for the first time ever a condition on aid to Israel. And I think Democrats are going to have a field day with that.
Well, let's talk about things that they should be doing that should be non-controversial. Biden flew to Israel for 7 hours of consultations right after the October 7th Hamas attack. And he came back empty-handed. He didn't even get the release of 400 or 500 American citizens, and with their families, they total 1,000 in Gaza. And, you know, he could have read the Riot Act to Israel and say, look, we got to let these people out. They're American citizens. He didn't do that. And there were no champions, except very few, in Congress saying, let our American citizens out. This is an outrage. They're in supreme danger. Now, why wouldn't a majority of Congress support that?
Look, I think immediately after October 7th, the impulse from the Biden administration, I think correctly, and many in Congress, was to rally around and support Israel in the shock and the grief of what was just an absolutely shocking and, for many people, unthinkable. I mean, no matter, I'm someone who's followed Hamas for years, and I was shocked. I didn't imagine they had the capacity, and I certainly didn't imagine that they would engage in that level of brutality against civilians. I think that rallying around was to be expected, and I think it was appropriate. But, you know, it was fascinating for me watching the noises from Congress and this administration. The fact that there are American citizens in Gaza, seemed to just escape everyone's attention for at least the first couple weeks, even as Israel was bombing the crap out of the place. And this was while in parallel, you had members of Congress, you know, there's legislation that's been introduced, basically pushing the administration harder on helping Americans get out of Israel. I mean, I think it fits into the general racism that we see towards Palestinians in general. They just, their lives and their concerns don't count as much.
Well, speaking of that, you are an advocate of historical context. That's why you're effective in your outspoken positions with your foundation. And Israel's allowed to have its history, the Nazi Holocaust. The Palestinians are not allowed to have their own history. So we have pointed out that in 1978, in a book by Nahum Goldman, head of the World Zionist Organization, he quotes David Ben-Gurion in a conversation with him, the founder and first prime minister of Israel, is in effect saying, why would the Arabs ever try to have an agreement with us? It was their land and we took it. And the whole quote is in a letter to President Biden recently that we sent. That's the fundamental issue of justice behind the Palestinian cause. They didn't ask for this fight. This fight started in the wars in Europe, and that is often denied them. Their own history is denied them. The Israeli newspapers are now beginning to report again how Netanyahu, for years, supported and funded Hamas. In fact, Hamas was a small religious offshoot from the Muslim Brotherhood. And both the U.S. and Israel fostered it as a counterpoint to the secular Palestine Liberation Organization, known as the PLO, in the 1980s. And right up to the October 7th Hamas attack, the strategy of Netanyahu was to divide the Palestinians by supporting and funding Hamas, which meant they enabled Hamas to get the weapons that they got in the international trafficking business that goes on with weapons. And I've never seen a situation, Lara, where people are being so dehumanized. I mean, even in concentration camps around the world, they feed them food and water. They don't cut off food, water, medicine, electricity, and then bombard them with the latest U.S. military aircraft and equipment. They don't even have an opportunity to surrender. They just have an opportunity to die. And there are babies being born where their death certificate precedes their birth certificate as they die instantly, because of the bombing and the collateral effects of the bombing on any kind of sanitation, healthcare, and even family nurturing. So let me ask you this question. To what degree can Congress descend in dehumanizing the Palestinian people? Because if the shoe was on the other foot, it would be considered the most heinous anti-Semitism possible. And of course, there are the other anti-Semitism against Arabs, not only against Jews, but what has dehumanized the members to levels of savagery where Senator Tom Cotton, Harvard Law School graduate, can say, I don't care if Israel makes the rubble bounce in Gaza, or Nikki Haley saying, finish them off about Iran, finish them off, or Lindsey Graham making comments like, kill them all. What is it that has so dehumanized them and silenced dissent as you cover Congress day by day?
Look, I mean, that's a big question. You're talking about historical context. The number of times I've been in meetings over the years and I've had a member of Congress say to me, well, you know, land without a people for a people without a land. Or they've quoted back to me something like, well, listen, you know, Israel can't make peace so long as the Palestinians hate Jews more than they love their children, that kind of stuff. I mean, it's just this basic language which at a fundamental level dehumanizes Palestinians in such a way that you don't have to question whether what Israel is doing is right or wrong. The answer is whatever it is, it's right, because the other side is a monstrous anti-Semitic terrorist entity. And that sort of dehumanization, once you've established that as a baseline, deep racism, deep dehumanization, I mean, it's extremely effective because then anything goes. And let's say the dehumanization in Congress of Palestinians in terms of its concrete implications doesn't start with the aftermath of October 7th. You know, Palestinians in Gaza have been under a just devastating blockade for 16 years with the full support of the United States, right? I mean, the idea that at the start of this war, the general, the Israeli general can declare total blockade as in contrast to the partial blockade. So before, Israel would open the tap and let in more water, more food, more medicine, whatever, but now they can just turn it off completely. This is for a place where defenders of Israel say, well, it's not occupied anymore. You know, Sharon got out, it's not occupied. However, we have our hand and maintain our hand on the tap, deciding food, water, medicine, who can leave, who can go, who is registered in the population registry. There are cases, you know, of Palestinians where the family is, you know, a woman is visiting Gaza from the West Bank, has her baby in Gaza, and then she can't go back to the West Bank to be with her family because Israel says, well, your child is now in Gaza and you are illegal in Gaza, but if you go back, you'll never, I mean, this is occupation. This is total control of people's lives. And the world, including Congress, basically says, this is fine. The idea that this is fine and that one of the most populated places in the world living under this kind of blockade, including during periods of time, and we only know this because an Israeli human rights group went to the Supreme Court, we know that there was a period of time when the Israeli military literally calculated the number of calories it needed to allow entry into Gaza to prevent the population from starving. And that was all they were letting in.
So let's tap into your expertise here. The power of the pro-Israeli do-anything-you-want government lobby in the U.S. Now, it's often stated, and there have been books written on this, as you know, that AIPAC and its associated groups around the country have a whole number of PACs that they contribute to their friends in Congress. That's one factor. The second factor is that they mobilize as civic activists. I've often said, if AIPAC could only give a tutorial to progressive citizen groups on how to really influence Congress, progressive citizen groups would increase their influence immeasurably. Nobody has perfected the art of organized civic action on Congress. You never see a march or a rally by AIPAC. They don't have to march or demonstrate or rally. They bring 10,000 people here every year to their annual meeting, and they summon the members of Congress and the administration to say the right things on the podium to the audience. So that's two. One is mobilized citizen action, then there's campaign money. But most people don't realize that it's more granular than that. And I want to ask you, the almost fearful syndrome of not just wanting to be a friend of Israel, now the standard is a strong friend of Israel, an unconditional friend of Israel, regardless of what U.S. law and the U.N. Charter stipulate. They make life miserable for these members of Congress. I've had people in Congress say, you know, the slightest deviation from the path of AIPAC, and they swarm over us. They swarm our local offices. They call. They threaten. They indicate a primary challenger. They never give up. Now, why don't you characterize the granular nature of this extraordinary power, which even exceeds that of the NRA, on Israeli and Middle East policy, because we've got a lot to learn from the Israeli lobby on how to mobilize the grassroots. Someone knowing about all this told me that AIPAC doesn't have any more than 300,000 really active people in the congressional districts. Well, that's a lot of active people. I mean, auditing the military budget probably doesn't have 10, but tell us more about this remarkable unanimity, over 400 votes in the House and anywhere from 98 to 100 votes in the Senate.
Sure. So first, there's a couple of things. One is that it's interesting when I hear you describing this, part of me thinks, you know, oh, this is controversial. And every time we talk about this, people get mad. And then I find myself thinking everything that you've just said about AIPAC is something that AIPAC says to its own supporters proudly. They're very proud that they do this. They're proud of the very effective methods. They have developed an incredibly effective way of being a grassroots and an election financing force. They're proud of that. So I don't think people should feel uncomfortable talking about it. I do want to say, when we talk about, you know, 400 people voting yes or whatever, I mean, there is genuine support for Israel in Congress. Setting aside the idea that there's a lot of activity from AIPAC. I mean, you cannot talk about this without talking about the evangelicals, who are arguably as engaged at the grassroots and at the election financing level. They are maybe more even narrowly focused than pro-Israel forces sometimes from the Jewish side. The evangelicals have made Israel and support for Israel one of their red meat issues, along with abortion and anti-trans and all those things. It's right up there. So I wouldn't leave that out of the analysis. But in terms of what they're doing today, and today it's much easier to say how AIPAC does what it does. In the past, AIPAC, if you said, well, you know, they're a PAC, and they'd say, well, obviously you're an anti-Semite, you don't know us, we're not a PAC, we're the Public Affairs Committee, we don't give money, how dare you say it? And the fact is, everyone understood, everybody who ever worked with AIPAC knew that there are actual PACs that are aligned with AIPAC, that gave money, aligned with AIPAC's priorities, and there's enormous influence there. Influence that AIPAC was proud to have when talking about it to its supporters, but if anyone from who was critical of AIPAC talked about it, it was framed as anti-Semitic. But today we don't have to even talk about it that way. In the last election cycle, AIPAC launched a PAC, an actual political action committee, right? They raised money and they invested money and they targeted races. And it's exactly what you're saying. They targeted races where they essentially targeted progressives, and they backed challengers in progressive primaries where they thought that the incumbent was insufficiently pro-Israel or was anti-Israel. And they basically ran incredibly well-funded campaigns in races across the country to ensure that the person who was the Democratic candidate in what was seen as a Democratic safe seat would be somebody who was friendly to AIPAC and Israel. And they succeeded in almost every race where they played. They brought in such enormous money that it was, I think, arguably impossible for the people in those races to contend with it. And in the two races that they didn't win in, arguably, I mean, one, I think they engaged too late, and one, I think they would argue they didn't put enough money in. So, I mean, it speaks for itself. And they were proud of it. They put out press releases, how they had actually beaten back all of these anti-Israel forces in all these primaries. And interestingly, in almost all of these primary races in the last election cycle, they invested the money via a PAC that doesn't have the word Israel in it. It doesn't say anything about their actual agenda. And they ran ads that largely didn't talk about Israel at all, which suggests, you know, when they announced proudly that they had proven that pro-Israel was good policy and good politics, and that's what the people wanted, when in fact they had actually run against the progressive candidates on issues that had nothing to do with Israel, and the votes against them had nothing to do with whether people liked or didn't like them on Israel. They ran on other issues, but it was enormously effective. Now, the question was asked immediately afterwards, can they do this again? Can they do this over and over? And I think the answer is probably they can do it again. They have plenty of money and plenty of energy, but they probably won't need to do it again because the chilling effect here is real. I mean, if you are a candidate or if you're a sitting member of Congress, and let's remember House members, I'm sure your audience knows, they are always, when you have an election every 2 years, you're always running. The minute you win is the minute your next campaign starts. And if you now understand, as a Democrat in a safe Democratic seat, that if you get an inch off the reservation on Israel-Palestine, you are going to likely face a primary challenger who is going to be so massively funded, it is going to hijack your entire campaign. And if you're the Democratic Party and you know that going forward, if people in your caucus step up the reservation an inch on Israel-Palestine, the party is going to have to divert resources from competitive races in other places to support Democrats in what are supposed to be safe seats because of an AIPAC-backed challenger. I mean, this is something that has a chilling effect on elections everywhere.
Well, let's look at the opposition to that, because there are rallies and demonstrations day after day in the United States now on the situation in Gaza. Jewish Voice for Peace has demonstrated extraordinary organizational skills in getting people out. Muslims, Jews, Christians, big rally in Philadelphia, Boston, Washington, D.C. coming up. The demonstrations, they're remarkably diverse. And I think heroic in many ways. Do you think it's going to change one vote in Congress?
I agree. I think they are remarkable and heroic, and they're one of the few points of hope and light. I feel this way. I know a lot of my colleagues, both Palestinians and Jewish, feel this way. And it's JVP, it's If Not Now, it's a whole grassroots movement, and it's intersectional. I know that that's a dirty word for people on the right. I'm going to claim it as something that's good. It's people who are recognizing that the equities at stake in Gaza today are not just Israel-Palestine equities. They're not just about, you know, Jews, Muslims, whatever. These are about everybody. And the implications of what's happening on the ground are far-reaching and frankly terrifying. So, I mean, I think that is amazing and heroic. I think the fact that they are happening in and of themselves is important. And it's important at the societal level, where we are seeing an unquestionably a resurgence in anti-Semitism. When I say anti-Semitism, I am not I do not mean that to refer to pro-Palestine activism or Palestine rights activism or criticism of Israel. That is a false conflation. It needs to be resisted, but there is actual anti-Semitism resurgence. On top of that, we have active Islamophobia resurgent. We have anti-Palestinian racism. I mean, in a country where since this war started, we had a six-year-old stabbed to death because he was Palestinian, stabbed to death in his own home, you would think this would be a higher priority. I think these demonstrations of solidarity and joint values and purpose are hugely important. In terms of what impact they have on elected officials, look, I think already we're seeing some shifting in Congress away from the, you can't talk about ceasefire. I mean, we're in the most bizarre place where we have almost 10,000 Palestinians dead on the ground in Gaza. And the narrative that is being pushed out by the Israeli government and its supporters here, including in the US administration, is that to talk about ceasefire is repugnant. It's just utterly surreal. And I think the grassroots mobilization combined with the facts of what's happening on the ground are having an effect. We're seeing at least more humanitarian concern, more willingness to talk about a humanitarian pause. I don't know why that's somehow better than a ceasefire. The term makes people more comfortable. Or stop the bombing, as I think Mark Pocan said the other day. I think that's positive. I think that does reflect that there is pressure. Beyond that, I mean, I think a lot of the grassroots today, this is a generation that I think is taking lessons from the failures of the grassroots during the Iraq War. I mean, they're much more focused in their mobilization. They're more focused in their message. They are targeting members in their offices. And on top of that, I don't think anyone's quite figured out what the implications are for the Democratic Party in the next elections, because polling suggests that the Biden administration's policy thus far, and I don't know if it's already a point of no return. I suspect it is, frankly. It's just so horrific. At the point when in the middle of massacres, the Biden administration decides it's time to start questioning the numbers of how many have died, which is utterly dehumanizing. And I'm sorry, it's utterly racist. There are clearly massacres going on. And that's the point you want to take. I mean, there's a question of whether or not Biden can win Michigan. And there are suggestions by pollsters that this is not just going to be at the top of the ticket. It's going to be down ticket as well. And that speaks to the absolute sense of betrayal and outrage from Arab Americans, Muslim Americans. And that goes further into the progressive world with this is intersectional. You know, when you listen to some of the most, you know, brilliant people in Black American intellectuals saying this isn't complicated. Here's why. People recognize what's going on. They recognize what Israel is doing, and that does not suggest support for Hamas or lack of empathy for Israeli victims and for Israeli hostages and their families. But they recognize that Israel is exploiting that empathy and that victimhood to commit war crimes, and the administration is supporting it. And the sense that the administration is supporting it because Israel gets special rules and because there is deep racism against the people who are being killed, I think the implications for that for the next round of elections are going to be huge.
That was Laura Friedman, president of the Foundation for Middle East Peace. She's a former officer in the U.S. Foreign Service with diplomatic postings in Jerusalem, Washington, Tunis, and Beirut. She was the guest of Ralph Nader on a special edition of his weekly radio program, The Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Recorded on November 3rd, it is an urgent response to the bombing of Gaza. Please go to the website ralphnaderradiohour.com to listen to the full one-hour version of Ceasefire Now.
My name is Moriah Gelarden. Thank you for listening.